Happy Friday at the Clemson Dubcast. Appreciate you tuning in. We are now on Spotify as of a couple of days ago at the suggestion of a follower on Twitter. So there's that in addition to numerous other platforms you can download or stream: iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, others. Feel free to drop us a line if there's some other platform where you're not finding it. You can reach out on Twitter at LarryWilliamsTI or via email ClemsonDubcast@gmail.com. It was a thrill to sit down with Dan Benesch in our last podcast. Also a thrill to sit down with Whitey Jordan in the previous one. A lot of great feedback from you folks out there, so really happy y'all enjoyed those. On the site at TigerIllustrated.com right now, got the weekly video review segment, really popular item at TI. Taking a look at some new wrinkles, a couple of new wrinkles Clemson rolled out against Georgia Southern last week that might have escaped the eyes of people watching it live. Interesting stuff there. Also taking a look at the Tigers' offensive line and Georgia Tech and how Clemson might be able to exploit those Yellow Jackets in Atlanta on Saturday afternoon. Title sponsor of the Clemson Dubcast, Parham Smith and Archenhold Law Firm in Greenville. Very happy to have them aboard. Couldn't do it without them. Blake Smith and Brooke Archenhold, both Clemson grads, both huge fans. Forte of their firm is medical negligence. They represent patients and their family members in medical negligence actions. They also handle all sorts of other complex personal injury litigation. I can vouch for them. About 10 years ago, a family member had a pretty serious medical situation with one of the local hospitals. Went to Blake Smith, and he very quickly and authoritatively gave us some great advice, and we were very thankful for that. Parham Smith and Archenhold offers free consultations. Give them a call, 864-990-4581, or parhamlaw.com. Also, the Abernathy Boutique Hotel, proud sponsor of ours, actually did the recorded the podcast with Dan Benesch last week at the Abernathy, one of the really nice conference rooms. We went to Taps Bar and grabbed a beverage, went into the conference room overlooking 93 and with Death Valley in the distance, had a really nice conversation. The Abernathy has tailgate parties, cookouts on game days right out there on the patio. Everything's free, cornhole, hot dogs, burgers, DJ, a lot of fun over there, right across from Lower Lot 2. The bar staff inside, really nice and helpful. Some really good beers on tap. The Hugie Street IPA is one of my favorites. And yes, it's Hugie, not Huger, in case you were wondering. TheAbernathy.com. Go check them out. Okay, our podcast guest this week, Chris Lowe of ESPN.com. You would be hard-pressed to find someone in the media industry covering college football who is more respected than Chris Lowe. Does a great job. It's 2018, and everybody's into hot takes and all that. Chris just has a refreshing approach in the way he both converses with fans on social media and such, and also in the way that he writes about the game and deals with the coaches. I've known Chris for a long time. He's a Palmetto State native. He's been around for quite a while, has a great relationship with Dabo Swinney. He comes to Clemson periodically to visit with Dabo and the coaching staff. He and Woody McCorvey go a long way back, so figured this would be a really good guest to both reflect on what Dabo has done here at Clemson and how he has built this program into such a powerhouse, and also plenty of other stuff. So hope y'all enjoy. All right, here we are with Chris Lowe of ESPN.com. And Chris, first of all, thank you for taking time to be with the Clemson Dubcast here.
And no, it's great to be with you, Larry. Always good to talk football.
How long have you been at ESPN?
Gosh, this is my going on 12 years. 11th year, going on 12 years. Hard to believe it's been that long, but it's been a good run. Just hope we can stay employed for a little bit longer.
Don't we all? And so before that, I guess this is around 2006 or so that you went to ESPN. You were with the Tennessean covering the Vols for how long?
Right. Yeah, 10 years. I was in Nashville for 10 years covering Tennessee and some SEC stuff. And that was a good run. And it actually coincided with really probably the best run in Tennessee football history. When you look at my first year, that was 97, they won the SEC, and the 98 won the national championship. You know, had a chance to be back in 99 and, you know, were a loss away in 2001. So I can assure you, Larry, that Vol fans would give anything to have those days back.
It's so funny that you say that, Chris, sort of treasuring what you have, because recently, as I've gone to speak to Clemson groups on an occasional basis through the year, I tell them, I say, look, you know, when I was just starting out, I was at the Augusta Chronicle, and so I covered South Carolina, some Georgia predominantly, Clemson, of course, some Georgia Tech. And I tell them, I remember what it was like when Tennessee would come to Columbia or when Florida State would come to Clemson. This is late 90s, early 2000. Or when Florida would come to Columbia, I would look at you guys, you included, when you'd walk in the press box, and I'd be like, man, I was jealous of the people who got to cover these powerhouse programs. And I'm like, at the time, it's like, man, what would it be like to be around that? And so I tell that story to Clemson folks as a way of saying, hey, I tell you, I treasure this just as a writer, being able to cover it, you know, having some distance from it, obviously, not as a fan, but the fans should truly treasure it because as you just said, Tennessee fans would probably give some limbs to have that some of that era back.
You know what a reminder is to me, Larry? It's enjoy the ride. You know, at no matter what school you're at. You know, Clemson, obviously, on just an incredible ride right now. Tennessee in the 90s and early 2000s. And you go back to Clemson in the Danny Ford era, you know, in the early 80s. Nothing's guaranteed. And the other thing I've learned in covering college football, you know, for 25 years is that it can change quickly. And sometimes the winds of change blow in pretty swiftly. And it can always get worse. And Tennessee's another great example of that. You know, when they ran Fulmer out of there in 08, the program had clearly dipped. But the standard, I think, was so high. And much of it is a credit to him for raising those expectations that I don't think anybody considered, you know, this can get a whole lot worse. You know, he got fired in 08. In 07, they played in the SEC championship game and were a pick six away from beating LSU and winning the SEC title the year that LSU won the national championship. And since then, Tennessee hasn't sniffed national relevance. So it can always get worse. And fan bases really, you know, again, my advice is enjoy the ride. Soak it all up because you never – college football is so cyclical, as you well know, and getting the right guy there as head coach, which Clemson fans can relate, having Dabo Swinney, who I think is the best fit for any school in America. I don't think there's a better fit head coach to school than Dabo Swinney at Clemson. I would say David Cutcliffe at Duke is pretty close, but I don't think there's anybody a better fit for that particular school than Dabo. So, enjoy it, soak it up. Smell the roses because it can change.
Now, you still live in Knoxville, so you have your finger on the pulse still of the Clemson, I'm sorry, the Tennessee fan base, the administration, and all that. Is there a feeling now, in hindsight, that they were too quick to pull the trigger? I think they're like a little above 500 since Fulmer left.
I think the people that are realistic will admit that. Some people are just stubborn, as you know. say, well, it was the right thing to do. It didn't work out. But, you know, and it had gotten a little stale under Phil. He'll tell you that. In fact, his comment to me, and he said it a couple times, is I let it get to a point to where people felt like they needed to make a move. And that's on him. And again, I think it's, you know, when you look at Tennessee over the last 40 years, Larry, the outlier really is that 93 or really 90 to 2001. They, other than that stretch, they've been about an eight and a half win a year type of program, going all the way back to the, you know, late 60s, early 70s. I think some people feel like that, or will admit now that they pulled the plug too early. But it happens everywhere. I mean, everybody that spends a bunch of money on college football, which pretty much everybody in the South does, and treats it as something a little bit more than an extracurricular activity, thinks that they should be winning and playing for championships every year, every other year. I mean, I had that same conversation with Dabo when I was there this spring. And he says, listen, he says, I'm not going to go down that road that anything other than a championship here is a disappointment. He said, I'm just never going to let it get to that point. He said, now listen, I know the fans here have reached that point because they've been so successful there under Dabo in the last several years. He said, but I'm not going to do that. You know, we're going to keep doing what we do. And that's easier said than done. When you taste success at the highest level, the way Clemson has, the way Alabama. I mean, see, what we're seeing at Alabama right now under Saban, to me, is the greatest run in modern football, college football history. I don't know that we'll ever see another run like that in our lifetime, Larry. And the scary thing for everybody outside Alabama is I don't know when it's going to end. You know, you look at people say, well, sooner or later, he's going to get tired, too old. Well, haven't been around Nick a bunch over the last few years and had conversations with him. He's not walking away anytime soon, especially the way they got it going. And he's just not wired to do anything else but coach football. He'll tell you that. So it's just, it's been hard. I think, I don't know if this is exactly the figure, but I think since he came there as head coach in 07, Larry, there have been 42 other head coaches in the SEC. 42. That's staggering.
Wow. So you, when covering Tennessee, developed relationships with Dan Brooks, the longtime defensive line coach at Tennessee, who became the longtime defensive line coach at Clemson before he retired, I guess, a year and a half ago. You also developed a relationship with Woody McCorvey, who was at Tennessee when you were there and who was one of the first people Dabo hired. I guess Woody had been at Mississippi State at that time. But what is your impression in having dealt with Woody and Dan and having known them closely of what it was like and is like, in McCorvey's case, to work for Dabo and to be part of such a, I guess, such a story?
Yeah. You know, it's a reminder to me and everybody else that knows Dabo and has gotten to know him, and you obviously know him very well, that Dabo Swinney hires people first and coaches second. And I know that maybe some people say, well, that's a cliche. No, it's not. I mean, that's the way Dabo rolls. That's what he believes in. If he thinks somebody's a really good football coach but doesn't fit in from a people perspective, fit in with his vision for how a program should be run, how you treat kids, how you go about, you know, running your program, managing your program, he's not going to hire you. Woody McCorvey probably knows Dabo Swinney as well as anybody in the profession. You know, he coached him. He was his position coach at Alabama. And you're right. I think Woody's the first guy when Dabo got the job that he hired. He's been a huge asset. What a resource he's been to Dabo there, and bouncing things off of, how to manage players, how to manage personalities, when situations come up, the head coaches. I mean, there's so many things at a place like Clemson as a head coach that you've got to manage. Not only players, but the situations, just things that happen every day. And I know Woody is one of Dabo's most trusted mentality. And Dan Brooks, the same way. Dan Brooks, to me, was easily one of the best defensive line coaches in all of college football. But look at the people he's worked with and coached at Tennessee, at Clemson. And you talk to every one of those guys right on down the line, you know, Brady Jarrett, John Henderson at Tennessee. I mean, they'll tell you that Dan is outstanding. But what a rock-solid guy. And a guy that's as honest and stubborn as the day is long. All right, but just the kind of person that moms and dads want to send their kid to play for, because they know he's going to have their best interest at heart. He's a little bit old school. He's not a little bit old school. He's a lot of bit old school. And so as I look at Dabo's success, you know, the big thing is everybody knows how great he is at connecting with people of all walks of life, relating. But he's been pretty darn good too, Larry, at hiring people. And surrounding himself with not necessarily yes men, but people that he feels like, again, see the world, see college football the way he does, are going to challenge him, and are going to be there to help him when he's got to make tough decisions. And I think he's done that right on through. And even when he's lost people, you know, to other jobs, or of course in Dan's case, he retired. He's been able to replace them with good people. Look around college football now, man. The fact that he's been able to keep Brent Venables, and again, it tells you the importance of investing and reinvesting, and how much they paid Brent to keep him there. And Chad Morris. I mean, you go right on down the line. You know, Tony Elliott, Jeff Scott. I mean, he has surrounded himself, and I love that. And we've talked about this, the two of us have. I love when people say, well, this head coach is overrated. He milked this coach or that coach, or he wasn't as good when he lost this coach, or this coach sort of carried him. Well, last time I checked, being a really good head coach and a successful head coach, a big part of that was surrounding yourself with good people and people that ultimately want to be a head coach and are qualified to be head coaches. And that's what Dabo's done at Clemson.
Chris, I'm sure that you, just about like everybody else, back in 2008, 2009, 2010, even 2011, were looking at the Dabo hire and saying, man, I'm just not sure. You know, scratching your head, wondering if he had what it took to guide them into sort of a sustaining winning program. There might be one person on the planet, Dabo himself, who thought that he was going to get it to where he's gotten it now. Is there anything back then, amid all those doubts and all that sort of, I don't want to say cynicism, but just the belief that this guy might not have what it takes, that Woody or maybe Dan told you, because they were sort of inside the bubble, anything they told you that maybe made you rethink a position on Dabo and think, you know, maybe he does have what it takes?
Well, I can remember talking to Woody about it, and Woody said, Chris, this guy, you know, I know I'm repeating myself, he said, but this guy knows how to get through to people, motivate people, talk to people, get people to buy in. And now as we look back, of course, hindsight 2020, who does that better than Dabo right now in college football? Nobody. Saban, you know, of course, they're two diametrically different in as far as styles, but probably a little bit more alike than people realize. But Dabo does it at least as well as anybody. So, yeah, I remember having that conversation with Woody, but I didn't know. I mean, at that time, I thought Dabo was a little goofy. He still is a little goofy. You know? He'll probably tell you that himself. you didn't know enough about him as a head coach and being able to manage and wear all the different hats that a head coach does. But no, I can remember vividly talking to Woody about that. And I knew we could recruit. We knew we could recruit. But, again, it's different in recruiting as an assistant and being the head coach and the guy that is the face of the program. How would he manage the program? You know, how would he manage situations when they came up? I didn't know. I know, talking to Terry Don Phillips, who hired him, who had the guts to step out there and hire him, I can remember Terry saying, he'd go down to practice and watch Dabo, and right away there was something about Dabo's persona that jumped out at him. The way he coached his kids, the way he got on them, was tough on them, but the way they responded to him, you know, Terry Don was forward-thinking enough to take that plunge. And, you know, after that, you know, of course, it didn't go well initially. And Terry Don said, you know, I don't know if I was going to make it or anybody was going to make it, any of us. But it's a reminder that head coaches, good ones, come in all shapes, sizes, styles, approaches. You know, the some of the goofy things that he has said, he's not the only one. When you're winning and it works, then, and especially if it's genuine, and that's the thing I want to emphasize about Dabo, is a lot of people probably thought, and maybe still thought, but back then certainly, that he was a little, he could be a little phony, or it was sort of put on. But well, having had a chance to get to know Dabo very well over the years, I can promise you, it ain't nothing phony about it. That's Dabo to the core. What you see on camera, what you see on the practice field is him all the time. You talk to his kids, they'll tell you that. Everybody that's worked with him, that's coached him. But I think a lot of people, Larry, probably wondered, is this real? Is this guy, you know, is this who he is? Well, yeah, it is who he is, and it's worked for him because he's been genuine. But they've also won. I think a lot of that stuff, as you know, comes across a lot different when you're going to playoffs and you're winning championships and you're taking down the big boys. I mean, go at some of the goofy things that Butch Jones said over the last few years. Not that Dabo has said some of the things that he did, but he said things over the years that, you know, you go back to the whole spiel on Spurrier and, you know, Clemson's not South Carolina and all this. That all of a sudden sort of dissipates or doesn't become a big deal when you start winning championships. And it's just the way it is. It's the way it is. Not only Clemson, it's the way it is everywhere. And but again, I emphasize, Dabo is about as genuine a person. Is he perfect? No, I'm certainly not perfect either. But he's about as genuine a person in coaching as I've ever covered. And I've been doing this for 30-plus years.
So a lot of the listeners out there might not know that you're a Palmetto State native, grew up in Rock Hill, right?
That's right. Yeah, most of my childhood was spent in Rock Hill with the high school there. So I go back with Clemson, South Carolina. I go back to the Jim Carlin years, and, you know, gosh, even Charlie Pell. And, I guess the first Clemson game I ever saw there in Death Valley. What was Danny's first year there?
That would have been 78, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so probably Charlie Pell was still the coach. And then saw someone, Danny was there. So, yeah, I have a good handle on those two programs and the tradition and the rivalry. And the funny thing with me is I sort of grew up more a South Carolina fan. I was closer to Columbia and had been to more games, had more friends that were South Carolina fans. My family was not, you know, I didn't have any Gamecock ties. But as I got older and had a chance to go to Clemson and see some games, and, you know, Clemson just has a way that, the environment there, how awesome the campus is, are drawing you in. And so I'm one of the few people that grew up in that state that, you know, once, and of course, I went to college in Tennessee. And again, I never lived in Tennessee. I just went to school there. But I'm one of the few people that at 18 or 19, after I graduated high school and grew up, spent all my life in the state of South Carolina, that didn't really have a strong allegiance to either Clemson or South Carolina. I know that's probably hard for a lot of people to understand, but it's true to this day. And I've gotten to know so many awesome people from both schools. And people ask me all the time, Larry, and I know you get this too, is, well, who do you root for? Who do you like? I know you're in the media, but you got to root. Well, you know what? I don't really root for teams. I root for people. It could be a trainer. It could be an assistant equipment manager. It could be an assistant coach. It could be a head coach. It could be an assistant, you know, associate AD that you've met over the years who've been at three or four different schools. That's sort of the way I look at it. And having been close to both those programs over the years, it's the same way. You know, guys like Mr. Bradley, Tim Beray, Tommy West, you know, who coached there and stayed in contact with, Rich Bisaccia, you know, who coached at both places, Connor Shaw, the great quarterback at South Carolina, all those guys, you know, that that I've stayed in touch with, though, just Jerry Tharp, you know, who was at the SID at South Carolina. That, to me, is the best part of our job, is all the people you get to meet. And it's not always the star player or the head coach. It's the people, you know, the blood and guts of those programs that you get to meet and stay in touch with. And just like I was there for the Furman game to do a piece on the quarterbacks, it's so cool to come back and see all those people. And a lot of them there at Clemson are still there.
You know, it's funny you say people ask you all the time, who do you root for? And tell me if this has been your experience as well. When you tell them you don't really have a team, it seems like 8 out of 10 of them don't believe you.
Yeah, no, I get that too. My alma mater is Tennessee, and I certainly don't root against Tennessee, but Tennessee loses, I sleep as well that night as I do as if they win, you know. But I have very, very good friends in the profession that coach or defensive coordinators all over the country that I've been friends with for 20, 25, 30 years. I mean, Kevin Steele, for instance. I met Kevin Steele, who was, you know, defensive coordinator at Clemson. He's now at Auburn, done a tremendous job. I met Kevin back in 1995 when he was on the staff with the Carolina Panthers, coached under Dom Capers. I was covering the Panthers at that point. It was their first year of existence. Well, I've stayed in touch with Kevin ever since. You know, of course, he's been about everywhere there is to coach. Kevin's the ultimate nomad in coaching. He's coached everywhere. Woody McCorby's the same way. You know, Woody and I have stayed in touch, you know, all these years. There's so many coaches like that. And if you cover ball in the South, and particularly the SEC, these coaches all move around, you know, and you get to know them. And, you know, Charlie Strong is another one. You know, I met Charlie when he was coaching in South Carolina under Lou Holtz. You know, we stayed in touch and keep in touch all these years. But those are sort of, you know, I'll find myself in press boxes on Saturday looking to see how teams of these people that I know. Gosh, it could be a trainer or a team doctor or a sports information director, you know, that I got to know. And I'll look and see, well, how did that team do because of somebody that works there, as opposed to, well, I'm aligned closely with Clemson or Tennessee or Alabama or South Carolina.
Chris, when did you have an idea that this is what you wanted to do for a living?
When I was a little guy, man. I love basketball. I was a decent basketball player, played in high school, but I knew I had 5'11", pretty slow, could shoot it okay. I knew I had no chance to go play college ball, but, you know, gosh, ninth grade, eighth grade, I wanted to be in some type of sports media, sports broadcasting. Grew up in the golden era of radio, Larry. I mean, you think about the radio voices that were our eyes and ears when we grew up, you know, from Larry Munson to Jim Phillips to John Ward to Bob Fulton, Kaywood Ledford at Kentucky. And, you know, growing up right outside Charlotte, you know, at nights, I was able, albeit crackly, I was able to get a lot of those broadcasts. Of course, I could listen to Clemson South Carolina every Saturday, Bob Fulton and Jim Phillips. But I could get John Ward at night doing Tennessee games. I could get Larry Munson on WSB doing Georgia games. I could get Kaywood Ledford doing UK Hoops games at night on the Louisville station. Even some Jim Fife at Auburn. That was sort of my inspiration because, again, games weren't on television. I know that's hard for people that are under 40 to believe now, but very few games were on TV back in the 70s, even all into the 80s. And if you love college football, you know, you listen to these guys on the radio, and they painted the picture for you. And that was my inspiration, and that's really what got me into it. I've been so blessed, and I tell people this all the time. I mean, to do what I do for a living, it's been a great blessing. And again, I mean this sincerely, it's getting to meet people, you know, and all the friendships I've established. You know, the two of us go back forever, going back to our days working in the Carolinas, but and getting to go in press boxes and seeing, you know, people like you and Mark Schlabaugh and Phil Kornblut and all these people that I've known forever. You know, and it's Michael Smith, you know, who was now at the Sports Business Journal, but most of these people, David Newton, you know, covers the Panthers now for ESPN. A lot of these people, I go back to my Rock Hill days when I was working for the Rock Hill Herald, covering high school, Clemson, South Carolina. But that's, to me, that's been the most fun.
So what? Who were the coaches at Clemson and South Carolina when you were working in Rock Hill and covering college football?
Well, when I started, it was, let's see, I guess I was in North Carolina working for smaller papers up in the Carolinas, at Concord, North Carolina. I actually covered Natron Means in high school for Central Cabarrus High School. He was a punt returner. He was about 190 pounds in and returned punts. Imagine that. I think he played like 250 or 260 when he got up to the NFL. But I worked there for a few years and got back to Rock Hill, I guess in 89-ish, 88, 89-ish. And Coach Hatfield was at Clemson. He got to know Coach Hatfield pretty well. Still remember, I remember it like it was yesterday, being at the press conference when he stepped down and him walking down. I guess they had it at Jersey there. I don't remember where the press conference was held. And I can remember looking out the window and seeing he and his wife walking down the sidewalk together, you know, to announce that he was stepping down. And I never forget. You know, it's funny the things you remember. Willie T. Smith, who another great friend of mine, worked forever at the Greenville News and covered Clemson, South Carolina, covered the Panthers forever. He was sitting right to my left that day, and he pointed and he said, "There's the happiest person on the face of the planet right now." He was pointing to Coach Hatfield's wife. He was finally getting out of that that whole deal with all the flack he had taken. But I can still remember Willie T. saying that, and I'd say he probably was right.
So you didn't go straight from the Tennessean to ESPN. You actually went to the Tennessee Rivals site for a very period, right?
A very short time, and you would have still been there if the ESPN opportunity didn't come about. But I went there. It was the Tennessee BallQuest.com, Tennessee Rivals site, and they've done very well. I mean, they've grown. I mean, they've got, gosh, I think they've got 4 full-time people now covering the balls for them. And Brent Hubbs, a friend of mine, runs it and was there for, gosh, half a year maybe. And ESPN reached out. They were expanding their college football coverage. See, I had worked for ESPN as a correspondent. Back then, before, you know, they expanded their coverage, Larry, they only had maybe 1 or 2 people doing college football. And so they had people from all over the country that would write stories, do notebooks. You know, people out in the Pac-12, the Midwest, the SEC, up and down the Atlantic, your seaboard, Texas. And I was their SEC guy and did feature stories, notebooks weekly. It would run on ESPN.com in addition to my duties at the Tennessean, covering UT and doing some SEC stuff. And that sort of got my foot in the door. Well, when they expanded in 07, they reached out and wanted to hire me full-time. Well, I had just taken that job with BallQuest, which was essentially the same job at the Tennessean, covering UT, a little bit more specific, because at the Tennessean I did more than just UT. It was a good gig. I liked it. A lot of freedom, as you know, to write what you want to write, develop the kinds of stories you wanted to develop. And then the ESPN thing came available, and I just felt like it was one that, you know, I didn't immediately decide to do it, but I knew that if I didn't do it, that I'd probably always regret at least not seeing how it would, you know, all turn out.
Business owners, you need to know about Tandem Payment, credit card processing company headquartered in Greenville, South Carolina. Office is located throughout the Southeast. One of the owners is a 2005 Clemson grad. He's forced the other owner to become a huge Clemson fan as well. Business owners out there listening, you know how painful it is to get the weekly phone calls from the national processing companies promising, quote, the lowest rates in the industry. Tandem approaches this business completely different. They handle all their business face-to-face. Why would you trust the majority of your hard-earned money to somebody over the phone? Tandem utilizes a consultative approach where they look out for the best interest of their potential clients. First company across the country to receive the BBB Award for Integrity. Tandem also employs Clemson graduates as well as former Clemson football player Hot Rod McDowell. The newest program Tandem offers is called Cash Discount. You can eliminate up to 100% of your annual credit card processing fees. The best part, it encourages more cash transactions inside your business. Plus, you save the typical processing fees you pay annually. Call Tandem 864-672-1570 or tandempayment.com. So this, where we are right now, is a tumultuous period for newspapers. Everybody knows that. But even back in 2005, 2006, 2008, 2008 is when I made the move from the Post and Courier to Tiger Illustrated, there were some dark clouds circling back then too. Can you give me a sense of what you were thinking back then as you made the decision to leave a really good gig with the Nashville Tennessean, high profile covering Tennessee, over to the rival site?
Yeah, you know, some people thought I was crazy when I did that, because at that time, the Tennessean was, gosh, close to 200,000 circulation paper daily, 180, 190, 300 on Sundays. But I could sort of see signs, Larry, that budgets were being cut. We were doing less things, going less places, fewer places to cover things. We weren't covering it. I mean, because when they hired me, I give Tennessee credit. I was the first person that they hired and put in Knoxville solely just to cover UT. And that was 97. And we went everywhere, every basketball game, every football game, I was every practice. I mean, anything, I'd travel to do stories on players or anybody that was connected to Tennessee. Did some Lady Vols with Pat Summitt. And so you could sort of see there in 06, 05, it started to change. And again, the budgets were cut. It just, there wasn't that investment. And I knew with that model, the Rivals model, that in the realm of Clemson football and Alabama football and Tennessee football and Ohio State football, there was always going to be a huge market clamoring for every morsel of information, and that people would pay for it. If you're good, hey, I don't care how much it changes. We laugh about this all the time. Don't laugh about it. Talk about it. It's still an information business. And people are going to always pay, and there's always going to be a need and a desire for good, timely, informed information and perspective and insight. And having covered the beat for 10 years, and I was friends with Brent Hubbs, who was, you know, heading up that Tennessee site, I just felt like it was a move that was a smart one at that time. And it was and again, I think had ESPN not come along, I think I'd probably still be there. My kids are growing up in Knoxville. We live about 30 or 40 minutes west of Knoxville in a community called Farragut. And great place to raise a family. I'd probably still be there, because I do think that's the model now. As I look at, and I've told you this numerous times, as I look at our business, especially as it relates to covering college football, I think your model, the team model, especially if you've got people on staff that are entrenched, have a good perspective and a good feel for that school and how to cover it, that's, to me, the most secure model out there.
Your job has evolved since you've been at ESPN. There was the conference blogger network. Now it's more of a national writer. I guess I'm phrasing that correctly. Correct me if I'm wrong. You've told me numerous times that you could never go back to being a beat guy covering one team. Can you maybe share sort of why that is?
Well, A, I'm too old. But it's just like you're on the front line every day. And when I covered UT for the Tennessean, I was one. I was the only person in Knoxville. I had basketball. I had football. I had the police blotter. And the police beat back in those days covering UT was pretty extensive. Let me just tell you. I had, remember, Pat Summitt had the Lady Vols going like gangbusters in basketball. You know, so every year I was, every postseason, and Tennessee basketball was pretty good back then too. So it was just constant. It was around the clock, and it's a young man's game, a young woman, a young man's game. It really is. And just having the ear to the ground, it's being on call 24/7. You know, I mean, listen, you've lived it. And that's just, I'll be 53 in October. And I'm just not sure I could put that toothpaste back in the tube, Larry. If I had to, I guess I could try. But I have so much respect for beat writers and covering one team, because A, it gets monotonous, okay? And especially with how limited the access is now, everywhere. You know, you get just a couple. I mean, I come from the era when you could grab players after practice. Imagine that now. Grab, hey, I want to grab Trevor Lawrence after practice, or I want to grab Christian Wilkins and Cleve Farrell. I got something I want to talk to him about. I mean, that's the way when I started to Tennessee in 97, that's the way it was. Grab Peyton Manning, Leonard Lowell, Al Wilson. Well, you know, everything's so streamlined now. It's harder than ever. You got to be more creative. You got to work around. You got to do things out of the box. And I think recruiting, probably certainly for what you do, is as important as ever. But it's the lifeblood of college football, and fans love recruiting. I love to tell the story. You've heard it from me. You know, when I started covering Tennessee in 97, there was no internet. And so we covered recruiting. And I know this sounds like prehistoric too. So I'd go to 1 o'clock game on Saturday and write a story in a notebook or a sidebar, and it would be in the paper the next morning. That'd be the first time it saw the light of day. Can you imagine that now? Think about how archaic that seems now. But recruiting, I mean, I'd write recruiting stories. I'd call a kid on a Tuesday night that Tennessee was recruiting. Maybe it was Georgia, Clemson, Tennessee, you know, Ole Miss or whatever. And I'd say, hey, give me your visits. What do you got lined up? You know, where are you going? Who do you like? I may talk to two or three of those and do a report the next morning on, you know, the latest update on Tennessee recruiting this January. And you're in peak recruiting season. So that was what we did. You know, you'd have three or four stories like that a week. They're recruiting because that's what people wanted to read about. And they it was almost like it was intoxicating, and still is for people. I had this attorney who would call me every day, Larry, from Nashville. I won't say his name, but a successful attorney. And he would call me every day wanting to know, hey, what's the latest on? And he knew far more about it than I did. What's the latest on this kid, that kid? Are they bringing this kid in? Do you think they can pull this kid away from this kid? And he would always end by saying, hey, if we get these two kids this weekend, do you think Tennessee can move into the top 10 of recruiting rank? And you know, mind you, this is my first year on the beat. I'm still sort of new a little bit. So after him asking me that about 8 or 9 times, I said, let me ask you a question. I said, at the end of the day, do you think it really matters? I mean, whether they're 9th or 12th or 18th? And he stopped me and said, Oh, yeah. I would much rather have a top 10 recruiting class than be finishing the top 10 in the Final Four. And I'm like, why? Why? He says, because it gives you hope. If you finish 9th in the Final Four, nobody remembers that. But if you finish 8th or 9th or 7th in recruiting rankings, that means going forward, there's going to be hope that there's maybe a championship in store for you. And that's sort of, I mean, it's crazy as that sounds. I think a lot of people look at it that way. You're not going to win the championship. What's next? Who's the next great quarterback? Who's the next great pass rusher? And I'm never floored by anything I hear along the lines of recruiting junkies. I'm sure you're not either. I'm sure you heard it all as well.
Tell me if you agree with this, Chris. I've long believed this, that newspapers in the late 90s, early 2000s, their biggest, I guess, mistake as it relates to sports coverage was ignoring the interests of the fans, of the subscribers who wanted to read more about recruiting, who wanted to have more places for discussion, who wanted more than one story a day. The things that newspapers were delivering in that format, I guess what I'm saying is if newspapers been paying attention, there'd be no Rivals. You get what I'm saying?
Now, you're right. The so-called powers that be felt like they could continue to dumb down the product, or that's probably not fair, water down the product, but still charge same rates for advertising, subscriptions, less, combine, and streamline. You know, you still see this where you're sharing content with papers in the state, so you get the same story. Everybody in the state gets the same story. Well, I don't care what you do, Larry. If there's less competition, whether you know, ask Dabo. What's Dabo's whole line that there at Clemson? That if you don't come to practice, you don't really feed on the practice for your Clemson, you're going to get exposed. Well, it's the same way in newspapers. If you don't have competition, your product's not going to be as good. I can remember, you know, competing against, you know, Knoxville and Memphis and Chattanooga, all these papers when I got on the beat in Nashville. Well, that sort of ceased because everybody's turned to sharing content. And you're right. You can't write enough about Clemson football, Alabama football, Tennessee football, recruiting, the players, and the personality, you know, and trend stories. And people want that. There's always going to be a market for that. And you're right, the interactive, you know, the message boards and chats. I can remember all the chat rooms when I was at ESPN. We'd have a couple chats a week. The people that were in charge of newspapers back then were asleep at the wheel. Unfortunately, I came up in the newspaper age. You did too. I still read newspapers. I love newspapers. I mean, and I'm a newspaper guy. That's the way I was trained. But they just were not able to evolve and adapt the way they needed to.
I'll never forget. This was around 2003, 2004, I guess. I had my computer flipped open in a press room, and I think I had a message board pulled up. I'm guessing it was the Tiger Illustrated message board, not sure. Another newspaper writer from within the state, I'm not going to say his name, sees what I'm looking at and says, "Oh my gosh, you actually read those message boards? Good grief." He was disgusted. And well, yeah, I kind of want to see what the fans are talking about. It was just the looking down your noses sort of, I guess, way they looked at fans was their biggest flaw, I guess, if that makes any sense.
The dot-coms, I can remember people in the industry, not only in the industry, but people at universities, they were in media relations back like around, I don't know, the late 90s, early 2000s, whenever, you know, whenever they all started to come about, we call them the dot-com. I don't know about these dot-coms. Well, I'd say the dot-coms have done pretty well. And but no, it's sad for me to see what's happened in newspapers. It really does. But I had, you know, starting about 05, 06, you know, I think a lot of us saw it coming. And again, you just, I don't care what business you're in, if you water down a product and expect to get the same return and charge the same rate, that's not realistic. It's not going to happen.
Or if you don't view your customers as customers.
Right. Give your customer what they want, customer service. And Larry, it is. It really is and always will be an information business. It's sometimes that line is drawn, whether especially where a lot of us work, is it entertainment? Is it news? And sometimes that line does get blurred. I'll be the first to admit that. But there's always going to be a market for college football fans in particular, for good, timely information, and for perspective that somebody such as yourself, who's covered something for as long as you have, can share an insight, your opinion, informed opinion, based on conversations with coaches, other people around the league, you know, family members, that's always going to be there, and that's what fans want. I mean, you can't give them enough of it. And that's the part, yeah, you're right. You've got to listen to your customers. You got to listen to your clientele, and I think newspapers are, again, not the people on the ground. And we all knew as newspaper people, it drove us crazy what was going to happen. But the people that were calling the shot, the people that were making the decision, were tone deaf.
You have a great relationship, Chris, with Steve Spurrier. And as you alluded to earlier, he and Dabo had some very entertaining fireworks between them periodically. Can you give a window into how Spurrier's view of Dabo evolved during that time and maybe even past when Spurrier decided to hang it up at South Carolina?
Well, I think Steve was a lot like me initially. Is this guy for real? You know, some of the goofy things Dabo would say. And then, of course, you know, let's face it, he beat up on Dabo there for a period. Well, they went five straight?
Five straight, yep.
And some of those teams were really good, Clemson teams they beat. But no, I haven't known Steve as long as I've known him. And he has tremendous respect for Dabo. I mean, they get along great. They really do. They I think they talk some. And they're probably a little bit more alike than people would believe. But the thing you got to remember about Spurrier is, if Steve sees you as a threat or a rival, he's going to poke at you. Think who was he poked at the most over the years?
Ray Goff.
Florida State.
Yeah.
Florida State and Bowden. Goff in Georgia. Fulmer in Tennessee. Dabo and Clemson. Well, who during those times at Florida and South Carolina were his biggest rivals? All the above. So, usually if he's not shooting at you, then that's probably a bad sign. He didn't think you're worthy, or he doesn't think you're very good, or he doesn't see you as legitimate. But no, I talked to him just last week, in fact, and he's amazed at what Dabo's done, the way he's recruiting, the way he's built. Not amazed, but just very, very impressed at what he's done, the way he's built that juggernaut there. And he says that he just doesn't see much end in sight. But, he invited Dabo up for his Hall of Fame dinner. Was that last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, last year.
Yeah, Dabo and Kat. Now, I think their relationship, and just like he and Fulmer are pretty close. They still talk. See, Steve never saw that. If you're a fan of Tennessee or a fan of Clemson and he's taking those shots, I mean, your blood would just boil. But he never really saw that as just, that's just him. I had a great conversation with his wife, Jerry, one time. She says, when he would start that, sometimes I would sort of go back behind him and say, he really didn't mean it the way it came out, or didn't mean it this way. What he was trying to say is this. And she said, after a while, I said, you know what? That's exactly what he meant. That's just who he is. He's an irritator. Even his own wife called him an irritator. But he was a master irritator. And that's just who he is, and he's never going to change. I mean, that was the beauty. I miss him. I miss having him in college football. I hate it ended for him the way it did. He does, too. He regrets walking away there the way he did. He should have walked away. He'll tell you the year before when they beat Miami in the bowl game. And that's something that he's going to have to live with, and it's something that will, unfortunately, probably be a part of what's otherwise an unbelievable legacy, because he changed the way they played football in the SEC, as you all know. Completely. And to have won as many SEC championships as he did and be as transcendent as he was as a coach, and then go to South Carolina. I mean, you covered South Carolina. I mean, South Carolina had not even come close to sniffing the success that they had under him. And I don't know, do you think they ever do? When do you think the next time we'll see South Carolina go three straight years and finish ranked in the top 10 again?
Never.
I mean, you never say never, but I don't see, I don't see it anytime soon. So, for all he did, I just hate it that's going to be a part. But you know what? He made that bed. He's got a line. And I don't know how much he thinks about it, but I know people that are close to him hate the way it ended for him. But again, he's so impulsive, as you well know. And when he gets something in his head, Larry, he's going to do it. He's going to say it. He's going to act upon it. And that's what happened.
I remember after South Carolina beat Clemson for the fifth straight year in 2013 in Columbia, Clemson turned it over, I think, six times.
Right.
And you talked to him, Spurrier, the next day, I believe, and he told you that they were lucky to win that game. And it was almost it was almost some foreshadowing in that Clemson sort of they owned the line of scrimmage, especially with their defensive line in that game. And Clemson did, and South Carolina was really fortunate. Can you recall that conversation you had with him?
Oh, yeah. No, it's exactly what he said. He said, I don't know how we won that game. He said, we couldn't run the ball at all. You know, they were just so good in the defensive line. Physically, they just, a lot of areas, they were just better than we were. He said, but they fumbled. Todd had some bad turnovers and, you know, typical Spurrier-esque fashion. Yeah, they just seemed to fumble the play and throw interceptions. Enough mistakes where we just beat them. I think they're probably better than we are. We're better in that game. We beat them, you know, and it seems to happen a lot when we play Clemson. You know, that's, again, that's sort of his, you know, backhanded compliment, if you will. But no, he knew that what Dabo was building there. He knew that they had were bringing in really, really good football players. And but that's the thing about Spurrier. All my time, he's usually pretty honest. If they win a game that he didn't think they were better than the other team, a lot of times he'd say, "Hey, we were lucky to win this one." You know, God's sure smiling us today. And he'd tell you when, you know, there were times that they didn't win where he felt like they probably deserved a better outcome. So that's the thing I always admired in him. He's pretty honest. He'd tell you that he felt like they were fortunate to win a football game. He didn't mind calling his own team lucky.
Last question, and then I'll allow you to turn your focus to the road. You're also really close with Nick Saban. You've developed a really good relationship with him, and you are very familiar with the inner workings of that program. Just curious, what's the biggest difference between these two powerhouses right now, Alabama and Clemson, in your mind?
Well, I think there's more similarities than there are differences, Larry. And I tell you where it starts, and I've seen it up close and personal in both places. The way Dabo and Nick both are able to get great football players to come in and buy in to competition and create competition on the practice field is unlike, I mean, maybe Ohio State's that level, but there's nobody else really else in college football like that. And they practice, their practices, I mean, it's on. And you can go to Clemson, you can go to Alabama, you go watch the defensive line work, and it's hard to tell the difference in the ones and twos. And the way they go after each other, and the way they're able to get a guy, even if they've got, you know, really good quarterbacks or really good linebackers, to get a guy that's the second or third-ranked linebacker in the country to come because he's not afraid of competition, because he knows it's going to make him better. I mean, there's a lot – in this day and age, you know, it's hard to do that. That, to me, is where they're most similar, is they've been able to create that kind of environment, that kind of culture. And Nick and Dabo both are able to get these guys to come in. I mean, think about Tua Tagovailoa signed with Alabama right after Jalen Hurts was named as a freshman SEC Offensive Player of the Year and took Alabama to the national championship game. And yet, Tua Tagovailoa comes to Alabama. Now, what's that tell you about Tua? He's not scared of competition, but you can point out examples like that across the board at Clemson and Alabama. And I think that, to me, is what sort of separated those two programs. How are they different? Well, yeah, I think Nick has a harder edge. I won't say a harder edge. He could be a little bit more of a bear.
Yeah, one doesn't matter. One doesn't mind being asked questions about his quarterbacks,
right,
and one
right.
does.
Yeah, Dabo's a little nicer sometimes, put it that way. But Dabo, no, listen, when Dabo needs to be a bear, he can. You know that.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I think Nick probably relies a little bit more on, I won't say intimidation, but that little Belichickian type approach, but there's also another side of him. And the players see it. He shows, because you can't recruit the way he does and not have a lot better personality than maybe he's given credit for. And I've had a chance to get in and see it. He does have a pretty good sense of humor, really does. And he loves to go out on the lake with the players. He takes the leadership council out there, but he loves to send messages, Larry, through especially the local media. He loves to send messages to fans and to his team. And sometimes, you know, he goes overboard doing that. But that's sort of his way. Everything's plotted out, planned. There's always a method, you know, to what he's going to say and how he's going to do it. I'd say that's probably one of the biggest differences. But they, the alignment at both schools, from the president, the board on down, to Dabo and staff, as far as investing in football, very, very similar. Very similar. They're, you know, the all-in phrase, well, I can promise you, Alabama and Clemson, when it comes to competing at the highest level of football, everybody's on board. Everybody's going in the same direction. And that's why both those schools, right now, if you ask me who the healthiest two football programs in America, it would be Clemson and Alabama. And they go Iowa State, maybe in that conversation. Of course, what's going on with Urban probably didn't help them. But I think Clemson and Alabama right now are out front of everybody.
Georgia's knocking on that door.
No, and I agree. And I think that I'm glad you said that, because Georgia sort of is becoming quickly the Alabama of the East with what Kirby's done there, the way he's recruiting. That state is just loaded with talent. I mean, it is loaded. What's the stat that per capita more high school players in that state are recruited by Division I football schools than any other state in the country?
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
And he's, again, Kirby's got a great staff. You talk about an edge. You talk about a guy that's on 24/7, a lot like his old boss at Alabama. That's Kirby. You know, he likes to get after the media and send his own messages, probably sometimes when, again, he's a little bit out over his skis in doing so. But everybody knows Kirby in that state. He's got connections and relationships. His dad was a high school coach. He's going to make it interesting. You know, and you look at sort of where geographically all those schools, because they all recruit a lot in the same footprint, Clemson, Georgia, Alabama, they're going to be serious recruiting battles among those three over the next few years. And it still gets back to getting great players. And Philip Fulmer used to always tell me, Larry, it ain't about the X's and O's, it's about the Jimmys and Joes.
Well, Chris, this has been a pleasure, I know, for me, and I know my listeners are going to get a lot out of it. Just really admire the way you go about your business, and really look up to you in that way, and just keep it up, and hope to see you soon on the trail somewhere. Maybe you'll cover Clemson sometime soon.
It's been a pleasure, man, and it's been great to watch all your success. It's always good to see. It seems like we see each other every playoffs. It's the Tigers in the playoffs every year. So I guess we'll make that a bet again this coming January.
Let's do it again. All right, Chris. Safe travels.
All right, man. Good luck.
All right, that was fun. Thank you to Chris Lowe for sharing so much of his time during a busy time of year. Thank you to title sponsor Parham Smith and Archenhold Law Firm in Greenville. Also the Abernathy Boutique Hotel in Clemson, and Tandem Payment in Greenville. Most of all, thank all of you for making this a part of your listening schedule. Everybody have a great weekend, and we'll have the next podcast dropping on Monday morning. Cheers.